Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast, and we're very pleased to have with us today two Jesuits who live here in America and have both written on Christian spirituality, Father James Martin and Father Roger Hayden. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Tim.
I'm going to ask each of you to introduce your books and tell us a little bit about who they're geared for. Father Jim, maybe we can start with you, since your book came out a couple years ago. It's The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, A Spirituality for Real Life.
Sure. Well, I wrote this book basically because there were a lot of great books on Ignatian spirituality and Jesuit spirituality, but my sense was that a lot of them were written for a kind of in crowd, that you had to know who St. Ignatius was, you had to know about prayer, and I really wanted to write a book that would be accessible to people who knew nothing about St. Ignatius, nothing about Ignatian spirituality, had never met a Jesuit, and also was might have a difficult time finding God in his or her life. So it was really meant to be a kind of, 0 to 60 book, soup to nuts. And, as I said, I stand on the shoulders of many giants, people like Bill Barry and Joe Tetlow and David Fleming, and people have written, on Ignatian spirituality for many years. But I was trying to make this book really accessible to anyone, from the beginner, to the person who's done a few retreats, to the person who's gone to a Jesuit college, but really an accessible introduction for a mainstream publisher to Ignatian spirituality. So that was what I was trying to do.
Now, Father Roger, your book is Christian Spirituality for Seekers, Reflections on the Spiritual Exercise of Ignatius Loyola. This has just been published recently by Orbis Books. I should mention you're a scholar in residence at Union Theological Seminary. Who are you writing this book for?
This book has an interesting history. I suppose all books have histories leading up to them, but this one has a very particular history. At Union Theological Seminary about 6 years ago, the president asked me to be a part of a team that had as its responsibility animating the spiritual life of the seminary, not myself, but part of a bigger team, students and other faculty people, and to offer a spiritual practicum. And what does a Jesuit do except give the spiritual exercises? But then you have to understand Union Theological Seminary, which is a Protestant seminary, liberal in caste, centrist in its doctrine, but very socially engaged, and a place attractive to a whole range of people, from believers to non-believers, from Christians of every stripe and those who are not affiliated with any particular church. There's some Jews, some Muslims who are there, and generally everyone's a seeker. In other words, they're looking for depth in their spiritual life, whether or not it comes from a Christian church. And so I wanted to offer the spiritual exercises, as I did the first time, to a group of 35 students, to a wide range of people who were every self-defined in every which way. Some were practicing Buddhist meditation and so on. And so this is an effort to open the spiritual exercises again to the seeker. And the seeker I describe as somebody who is looking for spiritual depth and asking questions. They may be moving towards the church or away from the church. They may or may not be enamored of the church. They're looking for answers for meaning in their lives. So spirituality I define not as Christian spirituality, but simply as a depth of living that is reflective as I say, looking for stable meaning.
How was it received when you first started doing these sessions for folks up in Union?
Remarkably well. The whole effort was an experiment. I mean, I had no idea how this would go down. The majority, of course, were Protestant background and therefore not used to deep meditation in the sense that has come forward in the Catholic tradition through the mystics and so on. But remarkably well, people at the end summed up their experiences, no two alike, but in various ways of finding meaning and depth in encountering Jesus of Nazareth, because the focus is on Jesus of Nazareth, not the doctrines of Christian faith, but Jesus as he lived and modeled the rule of God in his ministry. They experience a variety of experiences of depth and meaning for their own lives.
Well, Father Jim, I might ask you to jump in right now. Do you have any questions for Father Roger about this book?
Yeah, I would say one of the interesting topics that a lot of Jesuit spiritual directors deal with all the time, I'm sure you've heard, is the spiritual exercises as presented to or as an invitation to people you know, who are seekers who might not be Christian. And I'm wondering what your experience of that was at Union and how that played out in people's lives up there.
Somewhat after I had done this, and I had a first text for it already before it had actually been published, Paul Nitter used these meditations. They're not meditations, really. They're really reflections on the ministry of Jesus in a course on Jesus and Buddha. And the formality was, here's a presentation of Jesus that can be appreciated by everybody. In other words, since it's Jesus' ministry, as depicted in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus is a public figure, and Jesus can be read by anybody and appreciated by everybody, because Ignatius presents Jesus and offers the meditations around the Gospel stories, emphasizing Jesus' humanity, not his divinity. He's a leader to be followed rather than a person to be worshipped. He's looking for disciples who will follow him. So that everybody, whether or not they were Christian, could sort of be in contact with Jesus of Nazareth. They didn't really need any apperceptive background or Christian upbringing and so on to say, here's a person who defined the rule of God and ministered to people in various capacities, teacher, healer, prophetic critic of society, in the name of God's rule. So people were very, very open to Jesus of Nazareth. Very few people are closed to Jesus of Nazareth. When they say they're closed to Jesus of Nazareth, it's usually the doctrines that turn them off about Jesus. But when they encounter Jesus in the Gospels, they're really energized by what he stands for and what he does. And
it's interesting. I think for the Christian who's going in it with an overtly Christian background and belief system, I think there's also, as they enter into the spiritual exercises, there's the confidence that, you know, the risen Christ is with them through the Spirit. And mm-hmm. I think that in a sense, helps people through a lot of the difficult times in the spiritual exercises and in the life of prayer, that there's that extra help, which may not be in the forefront of people's minds if they're still struggling with belief, mm-hmm. you know. But it is. I like the idea of them encountering Jesus, because yeah, you can't be uninterested in someone like Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah. Father Jim, who have you found the readers of your book to be? I mean, you mentioned, you know, Jesuit school grads. Have you get some seekers as well looking at the book?
I have, and you know, the book's been picked up. I've been very happy by Jesuit colleges and high schools and universities, and I'd hope that would be the case, because I think that even on Jesuit campuses and high schools and in churches, things like that, there are still people who are, you know, that don't have as much experience in prayer and in Jesuit spirituality. But a lot of seekers have told me, in particular, the examination of conscience, which I describe in the book, which is a very short practice of prayer that one does at the end of the day to find out where God has been in your life, has been extremely helpful for them. And in fact, that's the way I start off the book in terms of seeking God. It's looking at places where God is already active in your life. And even a person who's really sort of on the margins and struggling with their faith or looking for a sense of faith in their life, that's a really great way to jumpstart things, because you can actually point to this and say, look, you know, here's where you can start to see where God has already been present. And that's a kind of nice beginning for a lot of seekers. One of the chapters in my book on the examine comes from an actor I know who I was invited to do a workshop at an acting workshop, believe it or not. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? I'm not an actor. I can't talk about learning Shakespeare or, you know, movement or, you know, martial arts or something like that. So I did the examination of conscience. And I went through it with probably about 10 or 15 actors, and several of them were non-believers and a few were seekers. And at the end, one of the guys who described himself as a seeker, after looking back on his day, said, I never knew my yesterday was so beautiful. I mean, I never knew that there could be so much beauty there, which is a start. You know, this is a start for people to sort of see the beauty in their lives. So, yeah, it's been embraced by seekers, which has been very gratifying for me.
You have a section here, Father Roger, in your book. It's called The Genius of the Spiritual Exercises. This might be a good launching point for both of you to talk about, you know, what is the genius of the exercises?
I forget what I say in that section. I have to consult it. But if I were sort of just to sort of not consult it, but just say what I think is the genius of the exercises, it's twofold. And I still today marvel at these two aspects of Ignatius. The first is that he gives free play to the Spirit of God in a person's life. He tells the director absolutely straightforward, don't get in the role, don't get in the way of the role of the Spirit in each individual's life. In other words, he had absolute confidence in two things. One, that the Spirit of God was working in every individual's life, and person could resist it or go with it, and therefore directors are necessary as sounding boards. But Ignatius had absolute confidence that the Spirit would be the final, ultimate director of these exercises. And secondly, a confidence in the human freedom of the person. The person is free to follow the Spirit. One does not suggest the decision that a person making the exercise should make. The director does not point the directee in any direction. The director there is to give the person confidence in his or her freedom and to allow that freedom to work its way. For the 16th century Christianity across the churches, to have such confidence in the individual's freedom and his or her responsiveness to the Spirit is simply remarkable. And it's so apropos to our own day today. I mean, we live in an utterly different world, but those two things are crucial for the exercises. And I think that that gets close to the genius, and along with it, the discernment of spirits, the movement towards a decision-making, the allowing of Jesus to be the model for decision-making, to see his own sort of absolute commitment to the rule of God as a model for a dedicated human life, to freedoms, for values outside the self as giving meaning to the individual. All of those are part of the genius. But at the core is the Spirit and freedom working together in the exercises.
Right, and this idea, I'd like to pick up on that idea of the director staying out of it, that the Spirit is the one who's really directing, you know, as we say to people when they're doing the spiritual exercises. And Ignatius has that great image of being like the pointer on the balance. If you've ever seen those old-time meat scales or produce scales, he says the pointer should be pointing straight up, that there should be no weight on either side. And I often use that, you know, with my directees. They'll say, well, what do you think? And I say, well, more importantly is, you know, what does God think and what's the Spirit telling you? You know, I think, you know, I agree with all of those points. I think I would add two things. One, to pick up on your earlier comment, it is the focus also on the person of Christ, you know, which is inherently attractive for people. And I think that's one of the things that I think draws people into the spiritual exercises. It's not a disembodied spirituality. Mm-hmm. It's not saying, now we're going to think about, well, you know, which he could have, now we're going to think about faith and hope and love. We're going to go through 4 weeks of that. It's focused on a person. The other thing I find, given the exercises and in doing them myself, that I found remarkable is that, you know, we all know that Ignatius based these spiritual exercises on his own experiences as well as on the experiences of other people. But what amazed me was, and what still amazes me, is how organic they are. When you're directing the exercises, you know, as most of our listeners will know, there are 4 weeks. They're divided into four so-called weeks. And, you know, you can do those over the space of a month or, you know, a year if you're doing them in daily life or, you know, in other ways. The first week is essentially on gratitude and a sort of awareness of your own sinfulness. The second week is on the ministry of Christ. The third week is on the passion. The fourth week is on the resurrection. Now, that's kind of simplification. When I began, you know, as a Jesuit, I thought that it was going to be kind of forced, but these things happen naturally. And so it shows Ignatius kind of the master psychologist too. You start off with gratitude, as most retreat directors will do today, and you're naturally brought into a sense of your own sinfulness. As Bill Creed, a Jesuit, said to me once, in the sunshine of God's love, you see your shadows. It's natural. the grace of the first week is to see yourself as a loved sinner. Naturally, you're grateful, and you want to what? You want to follow Jesus, and so it leads you to the second week, you know, of being on mission with Christ and entering into these great imaginative exercises, following Christ along the way, and then of course following Him into the third week. You enter into the Passion with Jesus, and it naturally leads to the resurrection and the final meditation on divine love, another meditation of gratitude. So it's very organic. When you're directing someone in the exercises, you don't have to force that, I think, mm-hmm. which is really beautiful. And I'd also like to add, I think, the other genius is the style of prayer. Now, Ignatius did not invent what would be called Ignatian contemplation or imaginative prayer. You know, the Franciscan, St. Francis, had that when you're thinking about the creche and sort of placing yourself there. But Ignatius popularized it, and I think that the type of prayer which both Roger and I talk about in our books, where one places oneself imaginatively in a scripture scene, is very powerful. And for people, as you were saying, who are not used to that, it's really revelatory. And to be able to experience God through your imagination and really feel yourself in those scenes and in those scripture passages with Christ. As David Fleming says in one of his books, you're not an observer, you're knee-deep in the Jordan River, you know, is really transforming for people. So that in itself is a bit of genius on Ignatius's part.
But let me pick up there. I just do want to add a little bit to the thing that you said and draw it out a little bit. These exercises, which turn to the scenes of Jesus's ministry with the use of the imagination and so on, are part of a program the way Ignatius has set that up. But they can be easily pulled out of that program and made into an everyday method of engaging the synoptic or the gospel stories as a method of prayer. Namely, there's no reason why this can't be simply a freelance way of anybody approaching the any given New Testament story and using it as a method of prayer. So the question of how to pray with Scripture, the technical term is Lectio Divina, and there are many different ways, and Ignatius even gives some examples that are different than the exercises themselves. But what I'm saying is the exercises in the five structured way that Ignatius gives of approaching a passage, of putting oneself in the presence of God, imagining the scene, putting one's into it, reflecting on it, and turning to God in prayer. These five steps can be something that can be done on the subway, that can be done while driving. It can be done at any time. It's a way of using the Scriptures, especially the New Testament, but the Scriptures generally, as a method of prayer.
You know, I agree, and I think once people encounter it, you know, if that's the way they like to pray, I was just talking to a friend just at lunch who was saying he finds that content-heavy prayer, as it were, with lots of images very appealing to him, but other people find it, you know, difficult. You know, they might find centering prayer more to their taste. But once you've encountered it, I think it's really appealing. And I think one of the things that people find is that they're able to see things that they might have missed, or they're able to get an emotional response to something they might have missed. I'll give you an example. I've given a talk in New England to a group of Catholic educators, and I led them through a guided meditation using this Ignatian contemplation on the multiplication of the loaves and fishes. And, you know, for readers or listeners who might not be familiar with it, you ask yourself, you know, what do I see? What do I hear? What do I feel? What do I touch? What do I smell? To really imagine yourself as much as you can in the scene, you know, trusting that God is going to work through your imagination. And so we did a very long contemplative reading of the multiplication of the loaves. And afterwards I said to the people, you know, what did you notice? And she said, you know, I never noticed the little boy there. And she said, I didn't know there was a little boy who brought the two fish and the two loaves. And she said, it dawned on me that Jesus was able to make something out of what little he brought. And I got very moved when I thought, you know, how what little things I bring, you know, God can transform. As well, she's an educator, and she's working with children, too. And so there's a sense that in many people, when they describe it, it's different than reading it, and it's different than hearing it proclaimed. There's a sort of affective response that happens that, you know, that is God working through that. And as my first spiritual director used to say, if you feel those things during prayer, pay attention, you know, because God's kind of working through that. So I agree completely. You don't have to be in the midst of the spiritual exercises or the long retreat or the daily exercises in daily life to be able to benefit from this kind of prayer. It's a really great gift Ignatius has.
One of the fascinating things about the exercises, to me at least, is that you have Jesuits engage in very different kinds of work, as the two of you, for example, engage in different kinds of work, yet this is what grounds you, and this is, you can both go back to this. Jim, you mentioned earlier some of the, you know, the shoulders you have stood on. Maybe Father Roger, you can talk a little bit about some of the people who formed your understanding of the exercises. You cite both the Ronners here, for example. Who did you draw on in writing this book?
Fundamentally, I allowed the text to speak to me, and I engaged the text. So I do have a theological kind of pantheon, a whole barrage of thinkers that give me this idea, that idea, and so on, eclectically. And that is thrown in. But one of the sort of, one of the charges of somebody explaining the exercises to a group of people who know nothing about them, as Jim described initially, is that the text itself becomes your main focus. And what you want to do is sort of not so much rely on what others have said about the text, but allow the text, as you have appropriated it, to communicate its logic and its inner meaning and so on. And so what I did was I relied pretty much on my being a Jesuit and the fact that the coinage of the exercises is a common one. It's the way Jesuits relate to each other. It gives us our medium of exchange. We use phrases from the exercises in order to make points. It's part of our conversation. So to take this world and to envisage somebody who knows nothing about it and to open it up for people and to ask this question that they will obviously have and which we tend to take for granted. Well, what really is the core of this? What really is the logic of the exercises? What really is the thing that makes them distinctively Jesuit, not Franciscan, Benedictine, or Dominican, for example? What is this sort of inspiring kernel? That's what inspired me in dealing with students, and really that's what this book is about. There's a lot of interpretations of the exercises that are no one else's. They're my interpretations, and I expect to get some critical feedback from some of them.
It's interesting, Roger, you're talking about the kernel. I heard Father Adolfo Nicolás, who's the Jesuit Superior General, identified as discernment of spirits on a little video he did. I'm not sure where he recorded it, but I thought that was very interesting because, you know, there are two ways of, or multiple ways, but there are two main ways of looking at the exercises, either as a way of drawing closer to God or as a way of making a decision, right? Now, The original subtitle of the book was about making decision, being free of disordered affections. And, of course, both of those things go hand in hand. One makes a decision to be close to God. One, you know, turns one's life over to God, those kinds of things. But he said that it was that Ignatian idea of the discernment of spirits, that one could weigh within oneself, you know, the different movements that are coming from God and that are not coming from God. And I thought that was very interesting that he would point to that and not, you know, say the two standards or something like that. He was very strong on that. And I find that that's another thing that you can, in a sense, excerpt from the exercises. You can use the techniques of the discernment of spirits, of making decisions in the Ignatian worldview with people who may not even know who Ignatius is. I also find that when people know that there is a kind of template for making decisions and for discernment, it just makes them calm, and they feel happy that they're able to. At least someone has given some thought to making decisions in a spiritual vein. So I'm curious to know what you think about that as a gift. Do you find that the discernment of spirits in your dealings with the students at Union, was that something they sort of found helpful?
It is, but let me take that discernment of spirits in yet another direction. I don't know if Father Nicolas brought this out, but a French Jesuit was answering the question about 20 years ago, Christophe Theobald, what is a distinctive method of theology for a Jesuit? And he turned to the discernment of spirits. Well, the discernment of spirits is in your experience. It's something that you are moved by. It's the God working within and responding or enabling you to respond to the world as it is around us. So it's an inspiration to be creative in responding to the world and not simply repeating things, but facing new problems with new answers. Well, if a Jesuit takes the discernment of spirits seriously, he has the basis for an experiential kind of theology, a theology that arises out of one's spirituality and not simply out of the received tradition. The received tradition is not left behind, but it's reappropriated through the power of the Spirit. This is a very, very important article, so important that Philip and Dean translated it again into English so it would be more widely available. A Jesuit's ability, then, to respond to the times, to respond to the problems at hand, to seek new theological insights and new approaches to theoretical and pastoral issues will be one that's responsive to the Spirit working within, not just the theologian, but within the community, within the church at large, and within the life of the community as it's suggesting new ways of directing our attention in ministry and new ways of interpreting the doctrine so that they make sense for people today.
Well, that's the thing. It's shocking for people sometimes when they recognize that God is at work within them. You know, it's not simply exteriorly. Father Jenner also said, you know, in one of these videos, they're on YouTube, if you just put in Adolfo Nicolas. He also said people can't be running to the priest every 5 minutes, you know, for the answer to their questions. You know, they're not going to run over the rectory and, you know, try to help, you know, someone make a decision about something. I found there's a book called Eyes to See, Ears to Hear by David Lonsdale that's very good on discernment. And early as a Jesuit, I remember thinking, you know, now what is it? How does this work? Does God sort of zap you with, you know, good feelings and feelings of peace and tranquility when you're in the right path? And does God zap you with feelings of disquiet and, Ignatius would say, gnawing anxiety when you're on the wrong path? And it wasn't until I read Lonsdale a couple years into my Jesuit life where it was really unlocked for me. And he says, basically, you know, things seem and feel in sync with God's Spirit because they are. It's not a sense of God kind of, you know, kind of gifting you with spirits of peace to make sure that you're on the right path. It's that you're in sync with God's Spirit. And so things feel, one of the great images is as if you're in the river, you're kind of with that current, you know. Mm. So I found that very helpful. And just to be able to present that to people and to say also that, you know, God is not only with you as you make your decisions. God wants you to make good and healthy and life-giving decisions. And so it's not as if you're just kind of white-knuckling this. You're not kind of, I often say to my directees, it's not about figuring out. It's not about figuring out a problem. It's sort of letting God kind of reveal God's self to you, you know, through these feelings of being in sync and of being in concert with God's Spirit. So that for me was a very helpful insight, and I thank, speaking of giants, I thank David Lonsdale for that.
Well, maybe we can close. This has been a very fruitful discussion. Father Roger brought up that, you know, this is part of the language that you all share, you know, Jesuits in various ministries. Maybe you can talk more about that, about how this language informs your work, each of you, and also, is that connection just kind of assumed between Jesuits, or what is that language?
Well, it's funny. I was nodding my head when Roger was talking, and I was thinking, it's our vocabulary. It's our common vocabulary, and it's hard even to answer that question, Tim, because it's almost like Ash and the Fish, you know, describe the sea in a sense. But I think it's not only the words that we use. I mean, if someone says, you know, I'm really struggling with something, you say, well, it sounds like you're really in the third week, right? Or if someone's talking about making a decision that seems really difficult, you say, you know, how's your discernment going, those kinds of things. But I think it's a kind of worldview that sort of undergirds everything we do. And I think beyond just the fact that, as Roger was saying, we all have the experience of the spiritual exercises. A Jesuit does the full exercises at least twice in his life at the end of the novitiate and at the end of formation, the final formation period called tertianship. But there's this sense that a person is always discerning, right? That a person, that the Jesuits with whom you live are always discerning, are always kind of seeking to find God's spirit in their lives. They're conforming themselves to the life of Christ. They've had this intimate relationship with Christ that's been kind of deepened in the spiritual exercises, and that in a sense you're living with people who are living out the fruits of the exercises. You know, I find that that gives me a great deal of comfort. You know, on the rare occasion when I find myself, you know, in conflict with someone in the community, I think that this person is discerning and is trying to see God's presence in his life, as Roger was saying, you know, within himself, in addition to just exteriorly. And so it really is, it is his great gift. It's St. Ignatius's great gift to the church, but it is what sort of binds the Society of Jesus together. And no matter, you know, I remember before I went away to work in Kenya for a couple years, my formation director said, you know, remember that everyone you live with, you know, even if they don't speak English, even if they come from a different country, even if you have no understanding of their culture, they've made the spiritual exercises. And I found that very moving, that they encountered Christ in their own way. And then the other thing to conclude is that you recognize that people encounter Christ in different ways. The Christ I encountered, it's the same Christ, it's the risen Christ, you know, in glory with the Father, who's, you know, is with us in the Spirit. But you know, the baptism at the Jordan might have been transformative for me and might have left another Jesuit cold. You know, one Jesuit likes to follow Christ on mission, and you know, he has a certain understanding of Christ. Another Jesuit likes to, you know, be with Christ at the Transfiguration or the infant Jesus at the Nativity. And so in a sense, it's very beautiful to me how God works personally with people, right? That God comes to us where we are. And so that's very beautiful too. And to say that my understanding and my way of looking at Christ in my life may be different than Roger's, or maybe different than yours, Tim. But that's very beautiful because God is very personal. And to conclude, that's the way Jesus acted in his life on earth. He was very personal to people. He knew that not every, you know, it's not one size fits all. He came to people in different ways and in different circumstances. So I think while it sort of binds us together, there's a great kind of differentiation as well, which is quite beautiful. It's, you know, it's the one and the many.
Well, maybe we'll end. Roger, we'll let you weigh in on this question.
Let me say two things about the exercises that Jesuits share in common, and I think everybody could share in common. The one is that they do have a vocabulary that's distinctive, and you kind of need a glossary and so on. People say, I'd love to read that book. How can I get it? And I said, no, don't read that book. Reading that book is like reading an assembly instructions for a complicated machine or something like that. In other words, it's a workbook. It's not a book to be read. It doesn't have a plot.
The exercises itself.
Yeah, someone said it's like reading a car manual or a cookbook. you can't just read it. You have to do it.
Yeah, exactly so. So that's one thing, the technical language, which Jesuits, of course, will share, and the mechanics of the various workings of the exercises. But there's another deeper thing. I have this phrase in the book, these exercises seem to be impenetrable. I say, not so. They're very, very basic and simple. They're contemplations, they're considerations of the stories of Jesus's ministry. At rock bottom, Ignatius was terribly impressed by Jesus, by the saints who followed Jesus, but Jesus is the one whom they followed, and he wanted to be a follower of Jesus, and so he dove into the New Testament and got into those stories and said, I want to do that too. I want to be a follower of my new leader. He substituted a royal leader for Jesus as his leader, and he wanted to be a follower or a disciple. So at bottom, they're absolutely simple and can be shared. They're a series of taking the stories of Jesus, entering into them, spread out over a long period of time so that they have an impact for goals that he sets up. But the core of them is utterly simple, it seems to me.
I was going to say, he liked Jesus and the New Testament so much that he added a story to it. with Jesus appearing to the Blessed Mother after the resurrection, saying that even though it wasn't in the New Testament, it may be piously believed that this happened.
Well, I want to thank both of you for joining this discussion and recommend both these books, Christian Spirituality for Seekers and The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything. Father Jim also has the book Between Heaven and Mirth, which is also out in paperback. But I want to thank you both.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tim, and thanks, Roger.
Yeah, I enjoyed it very much, Jim and Tim. Thanks.